The Pat Kenny Show
with Mater Private Network
on News Talk.
Tánaiste Leo Varadkar is with me in studio. Tánaiste, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
We're going to talk about the living wage in just a minute because you're introducing changes there. But I want to listen back to Michael D. Higgins. This is the comment he made yesterday at an event in Kildare that has everybody talking.
I have taken as well to speaking ever more frankly in relation to housing, because I think it is a great failure. It isn't a crisis anymore. It is a disaster. And I think that we have to really think about meeting the basic needs of people in a republic, be about food and shelter and education. And building homes is what is important. It is not to be a star performer for the speculative sector internationally or anything else.
Did the president cross a line, Leo Varadkar?
Well, you know, the president is somebody who's always been and is often outspoken in his views. Because he's the president, he is above politics, above party politics, and is immune in many ways from criticism and scrutiny. So, you know, I'm not going to be critical of him in any way. I think some of what he said was true, quite frankly.
What did he say that was true?
Well, that, you know, the housing crisis is a disaster for a lot of people. You know, for the 60 or 70% of us who own our own homes, whether it's outright or through a mortgage, that's not the case. But for people who are paying very high rents, often half their income in rents, that's a disaster. And it is a fact that in Ireland at the moment, very often, you know, a couple, both of whom have decent jobs, are unable to afford a home. And that wasn't the case for most of our history. And to me, that's a social disaster that, you know, people who are working hard, who have decent incomes, can't afford to buy a home. And many are so frustrated at that, they're even willing to turn to populism and nationalism and Euroscepticism as a solution. And in that scenario, that they may lose their job as well as a house.
Okay.
But that is a disaster in my view.
There's a lot to unpack in that, which I'm going to come back to. But the idea that the president is somebody who says something like this, it is an intervention on government policy, it is a commentary on government policy, is that a dangerous precedent?
I think it was a general commentary on policy, and not just in Ireland, perhaps more internationally. But
I think he was pretty much talking about this country.
Well, perhaps, yeah. But, you know, it's not for me to interpret the president's comments. You know, he is the president. He's the head of state. He's above politics and beyond criticism and scrutiny. So I'm not going to cross the line by being critical of him in any way.
The newspapers this morning seem to suggest that there is great disquiet at cabinet over what has been said. Have you spoken to colleagues? Are your colleagues upset by this? Have you spoken to the Taoiseach about these comments?
No. We had a cabinet meeting on Tuesday. I think that speech was made sometime yesterday, so I haven't actually spoken to any cabinet colleagues since then.
And as a result, do you think that this is something that Michael D. Higgins has said, you're going to move on from it, it's not something that's going to damage the relation between branches of government?
I think the president regularly makes speeches that are from the heart, that are passionate and are outspoken, and I don't think it's going to stop doing it. There's a mechanism by which the Taoiseach communicates with the president and vice versa. It's called Article 28 of the Constitution for those who are interested in that sort of thing, and had those meetings on and off with the president for 3 years when I was Taoiseach, and they're private meetings and they never leak, and that's the mechanism by which those conversations happen.
Lots of people who have been texting in agree with him. You've agreed with him here.
In part.
But you're saying that the housing crisis is a social disaster. Is that not a social disaster that sits on your watch? You've been in government for over 10 years at this point. The commentary was directed at not just this government, all the governments. Are you responsible for that social disaster?
We're responsible for solving it. I don't think we're responsible for the construction bubble and the housing crash and all those things
years.
That happened. All those things, you know, part of the reason why we have the housing crisis that we have is because 12 years ago, you know, we had a housing bubble, a banking collapse and a construction collapse, and I certainly wasn't responsible for that. We are responsible for fixing the problem. So what are the kind of things we're doing? And, you know, criticism and describing a problem is one thing. Coming up with solutions and operationalizing them and implementing them is quite a different thing. And that's the responsibility of government. So look at what we're doing, for example. One of the criticisms the president made.
Go back to the fact that you admit it's a social disaster, but do you accept it is your social disaster as somebody who is about to become Taoiseach again in December and who has been in government throughout that entire period? This is a failing of your government rather than a failing of anything else.
I think it's a failing of successive governments, and you
of
know,
which you've been part of.
Yeah, including with the Labour Party, with left-wing independents, now with Fianna Fáil. If you look at the situation north of the border, where Sinn Féin is in power for the best part of 20 years, homelessness, rents going up, you know, a lot of the same problems. So I think it's a criticism of all of us, and I accept that criticism. But what I'm more interested in is solving the problem and taking responsibility for solving the problem. So one of the criticisms the president made, which I think is correct, is that in the past, too much was left to the market. So how is the government responding to that? We now have the biggest social housing programme ever in the history of the state. About 9,000 new social houses will be provided this year. That's more than any time in the 80s or the 50s or in the 20s in the early period of the Free State. That's a big change in policy. We have, for example, the first time buyer's relief helped 30,000 people already. They get their taxes back, helped them to buy a home, opposed by some people, very much supported by me. We have a new semi-state. The LDA, which is a major state intervention in the housing market, building affordable homes for people to buy, cost rental a reality for the first time, was talked about for a long time. It's now a reality, started by Owen Murphy. The actual homes are now being built under this government.
Okay, but when are we going to see the results of that?
We've prices on rent caps. You know, for example, rents can now only increase by 2% a year. And that
well, we heard somebody earlier
relief.
Saying that their rent was going up by 70%. All of these things are inching in the right direction. The problem for you is by the time you get to the next general election, which is in, 2.5 years' time, nearly 3 years' time, they might not feel the benefits on the ground. You mightn't get the credit if it is 9,000 new homes. And someone else is going to eat your dinner.
Well, you know, whether we get the benefit of it or not electorally is less important to me than whether we make meaningful progress. And, you know, I think we can make meaningful progress in that period. As I say, you know, one of the things we have to do is increase housing supply. We lost a decade, essentially, in terms of housing construction. About 250,000 houses that should have been built weren't built. And that's at the heart of the problems that we face. But look at where we are now. We'll probably build about 25,000 new homes this year. That's a lot. About 35,000 have planning permission. Have started construction. And another 45,000 have planning permission. So, you know, we are starting to see supply come on stream, maybe just not quickly enough.
Let's talk about the living wage. It's something that the government has been championing for some time. A lot of employers have taken it on. Others are still working with the minimum wage. The legislation you're introducing and the proposed changes are going to gradually increase that minimum wage to the living wage. This is seen as a direct attempt to deal with the cost of living crisis. The automatic pushback you're going to get from industry is we can't afford this.
Well, you know, when I became Minister for Enterprise, Trade and Employment, I set out three objectives. You know, one was to help businesses to get through the pandemic and Brexit and make sure that they survived. And we've done that. The second objective was to make sure that we had record levels of employment in Ireland, 2.5 million people at work. We've achieved that. Jobs in all parts of the country now approaching full employment, probably at the point now where there are more vacancies than job seekers. That creates its own problems, but I'd rather have that than the reverse problem, which was mass unemployment. And it's not that long ago that people were emigrating from the country because they couldn't get jobs, and we're in a very different position now than we were 10 or 11 years ago. But I don't just want record numbers of people at work. You know, I want people to have good pay, better pay. I want them to have good terms and conditions. I want everyone to have access to a pension in addition to state pension. And these are the reforms that we're making. And things like the introduction of sick pay, for example, we'll have that in by the end of the year. Auto-enrollment, probably next year, the year after. And the living wage is all part of that. It's all part of improving pay, making sure that work pays for people and improving terms and conditions. And we're going to phase it in over a couple of years. But essentially what the Low Pay Commission has recommended, and that's the independent body made up of union reps, employer reps and independent experts, what they've recommended is that we should link the living wage, the new living wage, to 60 80% of median earnings, and that's what we intend to do. If that was the case today, the living wage would be €12.10 an hour rather than €10.50, which is what it is now, but we're going to phase that in over the next couple of years.
The problem, though, is that we are dealing with inflation that we haven't seen for many years. Any increase in living or indeed minimum wage is going to be instantly swallowed up at the moment. You're pitching it against the 60% of median, which is great, but ultimately this is going to be something that has to be revisited on a regular basis to make sure that people don't go hungry, can afford heating, can afford rent.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct, and it'll be revisited every year. And that's what will happen, is the Low Pay Commission will make a recommendation every year. You know, generally what happens when inflation rises is incomes rise too. And that actually can create a problem itself, because sometimes it can create a spiral of higher inflation. But we had a very prolonged period in Ireland and across the world of very low inflation, very low interest rates, and very modest pay increases. You know, all of that somewhere between 0 and 2% a year. We're now in a different phase where we are seeing significant inflation, but we are also going to see significant increases in real incomes too, or rather in nominal incomes, because people are going to get pay rises much greater than they did in the past. And they should, by the way. That's not a solution to the problem, but it is going to be part of dealing with the symptoms of inflation.
Do you share Pascal Donohue's confidence that you won't have to do any activity in the form of a mini budget, given the direction of travel at the moment of costs and inflation? I mean, we were speaking with people on the programme yesterday who have seen their fuel bills double. People who are working as public health nurses, whose mileage is no longer covering the costs of the petrol they're putting into their car. Is there something that's going to have to be done?
Well, you know, some things will be done. You know, you mentioned, for example, the example of the public health nurse. We're currently in negotiations today in the Workplace Relations Commission with regard to a new public service pay deal. And we would hope to come to an agreement that would see that public health nurse get a pay increase greater than the 1% that was planned
in
for October.
Right now.
And part of, and mileage, I imagine, will be part of that discussion, because, you know, we do need to reflect the reality for people who, you know, have to drive a car around the place as part of their work, whether it's a public health nurse, whether it's home help. We have to recognise the reality that petrol and diesel is much more expensive than it did before. So that's the kind of thing that you could see happen before the budget. But, you know, I'm curious to hear people talking about a mini budget. You know, in the budget, and the budget kicked in January, we had €1 billion of pension increases, welfare increases, and income tax relief. Since then, we've had a further €1.4 billion of reductions in excise on petrol and diesel, reductions in VAT on electricity and gas, the €200 discount from electricity bills, reduced public transport fares.
But so it's all been swallowed
up. That wasn't a mini budget.
That's the problem. You mentioned.
Yeah, but let me answer that, because that's very fair. That's a very, very fair comment. And that's, I think, where a lot of the opposition and the commentary would have it wrong, because they talk about the solution to the problem as always being treating the symptoms. Now, I'm a medical doctor. I know you have to treat the symptoms of a problem, but you have to treat the underlying cause as well. And if we're serious about getting inflation under control, there are things that we can do and things we want to do. So obviously, the European Central Bank has to do what it needs to do in terms of reining in money supply, and some of that's going to be unwelcome, but it is necessary, particularly when it comes to pulling in quantitative easing and not lending governments money so cheaply. That's part of the cause of inflation. But there are things that government can do to bring down the cost of living in a sustainable way. You know, we could take another 5 cents or 10 cents off petrol or diesel tomorrow and find out that it makes no difference, because we don't actually control the price of petrol and diesel. It's imported from abroad.
Yeah, but you do control a significant amount of the revenue that is drawn.
A proportion of it,
from.
Yeah.
A sizable proportion.
And a decreasing proportion all the time because of the fact that we've cut fuel taxes. But for example, we can do things like significantly reduce the cost of childcare. And if we bring that down, it'll stay down. We can reduce the cost of putting a child through college, which now is very expensive in Ireland. We can reduce the cost of medicines. We can reduce the cost of healthcare. And they're the kind of things that government can do in the budget that will be sustainable. And they're the kind of things that I really want to do, because, you know, we want to help working families. We want to help middle class people who pay very high childcare costs, spend a fortune putting kids through college, pay a lot of money on public transport. And they're the kind of changes that the government could make that actually will be sustainable. Whereas, you know, changing fuel taxes might make a difference and might not.
You mentioned VAT. Hotels in Dublin currently enjoy a 9% VAT rate that was introduced in that budget to help them recover from COVID. If you look at hotel rooms right now in Dublin, first of all, it's very hard to get them, trust me. I was looking. You're seeing very, very expensive rooms, all benefiting from 9%. Are hotels gouging, and is there going to be a repercussion for those hotels from the government?
I think there are some examples of bad practice and profiteering in the industry. I don't think every hotelier is doing this, by the way. Some of them are, not most. I appreciate that if you're running a hotel or you own a hotel, you're not running a charity, you're running a business. You've responsibility to make a profit for your shareholders. But what I say to people in the industry, and I'm, you know, a former tourism minister, I say to them that just because you can charge €600 for a basic hotel room doesn't mean you have to. And if you get a reputation for overcharging or for poor value for money, you'll actually pay a price in the long term. And this happened before, you know, 12, 15 years ago, Ireland got a reputation internationally for being a very expensive place for tourists to come to. And we need to make sure that we don't get that reputation again. So, you know, what I'd say to people working in the industry, in the hospitality industry, for to hoteliers, if you're thinking about increasing your profits, you know, don't think short term, think long term.
But what about the 9%? Is the 9% going to continue on while prices are being charged like the prices we're seeing now?
Well, it's been extended until February. And bear in mind, that's not just for hotels, it's for restaurants as well. It's for, you know, a lot of businesses that aren't hiking up prices, or if they are, it's because they have to, because they've rising input costs. And we've extended it to February in order to help them out. So we're not going to, you know, cancel that. But I imagine the hospitality industry will be coming to the government looking for it to be extended again beyond February, or they certainly will want us not to go back up to 13.5% in one fell swoop. They're weakening their case if they get a reputation for overcharging and bad value, and I think the vast majority of them get that.
The protocol, the British legislation that has been introduced, well, it's been brought before the Commons on the first reading. It's very hard to work out what the British are hoping to achieve from this. You negotiated part of this, and you spoke with Boris Johnson. What do you think their game plan is here? Is it purely to feed an internal audience in Westminster? And ultimately, do you think they're going to introduce this legislation? Are they going to pass it and ever draw on it? Or is it just a bargaining chip?
Look, it's impossible to predict what the real intentions of the British government are. They may not even know themselves. We had the threat to invoke Article 15, you'll remember that, and they didn't do it in the end. We had the Internal Markets Bill, which they didn't go through with in the end. We now have this proposed legislation, which at this stage is just proposed legislation. It hasn't gone through the Commons or Lords. And even if it does go through, it gives power to ministers that they may not necessarily use. But, you know, it's not right what they're doing. You know, the United Kingdom negotiated a treaty with the European Union, including Ireland, and a basic thing that a state is supposed to do is honour its treaty obligations, and they're now proposing to breach that, and I think it's a mistake. I think it's a mistake on their part, by the way. I was in Geneva on Sunday and Monday meeting trade ministers from all over the world, and they were talking about trade deals with the UK, and what was one of the things I said back to them? Well, you know, you might make a trade deal with the UK and a year later they might pass legislation to override it. Like, is this really a country that you can take seriously?
Well, is Boris Johnson trustworthy? I mean, you negotiated with him. You thought you had reached an agreement. Do you believe he's trustworthy?
I think the jury is out on that. I have to say, in my dealings with him, I found him trustworthy, but the current actions of the British government are not the actions of a trustworthy government if they go through with them. But, you know, one thing, there's two things that we need to get across, and I hope we can get this across in the British media as well. By and large, the protocol is working. It's not perfect, but it is working. There's no hard border between North and South. That was the objective. The single market and our place in it is being protected. The economy in Northern Ireland is outperforming any other part of the United Kingdom. So it is working. We can make changes, modifications, improvements to it. We're open to that and we want to negotiate on that. And also we need to bear in mind as well that the majority of MLAs elected to Stormont, elected to the Northern Ireland Assembly, do not support this legislation. They don't want UK ministers to have the power to revoke the protocol. The Northern Ireland Assembly has that power because Boris and I negotiated that and agreed that. So I think for ministers in London to override the wishes and the will of people in Northern Ireland is a very serious thing. And bizarrely, this is coming from a government that says it's pro-union, and yet it continues to try to impose things on Northern Ireland that people in Northern Ireland don't want. A legacy is another example of that. You know, you'd kind of wonder what they're at, really. They say they want to protect the union, and how do they prove that? By forcing things on the people of Northern Ireland that they don't want. That's a very strange logic, in my view.
Well, the EU has resumed their legal action against the UK following the publication of that bill that would overturn parts of the Northern Ireland Protocol. So this is going to end up in a very difficult legal quagmire, I suspect, but not get any clarity or resolution for business people. I want to talk about government. Lots of reports that yourselves and Fianna Fáil aren't getting on. Now, we could have predicted that, arguably. How serious are they? I mean, is your relationship with Micheál Martin a little tense?
They're not serious at all. The relationship is very good. It's got better over time. Gets better by the day and by the week. We're good colleagues. I trust him. I like him. I think he's doing an excellent job. The truth is, paper never refuses ink, especially on a Sunday. And Bertie Ahern always said to me, don't read the Sunday papers, because if you do, you'll always be annoyed. But sometimes I do. And I hear about these rows in government. And, like, surely if there's a row in government, I would have known about it, or I'd be there. But it's not. And sometimes what you have is a backbencher in one party saying something, and then a backbencher in another party saying something different. And the journalist manages to turn this into a row in government. And it's only nonsense. But if people want to spend their hard-earned money reading that kind of stuff, they can.
Well, the other thing that you'd have read in the Sunday paper is Sinn Féin being at 37% in the Red Sea poll, which is becoming perilously close to being the Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael figure combined. How worried are you about that?
Well, you know, it's one thing I do know, and that it's opinion polls do not predict the outcome of elections. Certainly didn't predict the outcome of the last election, you know, where Sinn Féin were in third place until we were well into the campaign, and didn't predict the outcome of the previous election.
Well, you finished third in the last election.
That's correct. But I think sometimes polls can be overinterpreted. Sinn Féin is doing very well in the polls, but they're largely doing that by cannibalising the rest of the opposition and the other left-wing parties. Social Democrats were in zero, for example, in that poll. Fine Gael was in 23, that's up from the last election. Fianna Fáil was in 22, that's the same as the last election. So what that poll shows is that the Fine Gael vote is up on the election, the Fine Gael Fianna Fáil vote is holding up, and what Sinn Féin is doing is it's cannibalising the rest of the left.
Okay, I'm going to come back to the living wage, because lots of people have texted in about that, and I'm going to go to those questions. But on the handover in December, when you take over as Taoiseach, or you're scheduled to take over as Taoiseach, there is still the issue of the Garda investigation and the files of the DPP hanging over you. How confident are you that you're going to be able to take on the role of Taoiseach if that isn't resolved by then?
Yeah, well, first of all, the Garda investigation is over and is concluded, and the Gardaí do not recommend a prosecution. But that's now a matter for the DPP for very good reasons. You'll understand why I'm not going to speculate about timelines or outcomes, because if I do, people will or people may say that I'm trying to put pressure on the DPP, and I'm not going to get into that space.
But if, and this is a speculative thing and it's in the public interest, I'm going to ask you, if the DPP, because the wheels of justice sometimes turn slowly, if they haven't reached a decision by the time December rolls around, will you take the office of Taoiseach?
If I answer that question, and I think you'll understand why I can't answer it, I'll be accused of trying to put pressure on the DPP, and I'm not going to do that.
Okay, so in other words, you're going to wait for the outcome whenever that comes through.
I'm not going to comment on something that is a matter for the DPP, an independent office that should be allowed to do its work.
Living wage is going to result in massive unemployment, in my opinion. Taking new sick day rules, new childcare rules, is becoming very difficult for small businesses, says one listener. This is a regular complaint. It happened when maternity leave was introduced. It happened when various social changes came in. But it's a legitimate concern. And how are you addressing that?
Yeah, it is a legitimate concern for a lot of businesses, you know, particularly small businesses, some of whom are still reeling from the pandemic and are finding it hard at the moment to turn a profit. There are other ways we can help business. You know, one thing I'm working on at the moment is reducing insurance costs, for example. We help business a lot through the pandemic with the employment wage subsidy scheme. So, you know, there are lots of things we can do to help business and help them offset some of these costs. But one thing I would say is that for as long as I can remember, those arguments have been made. when the minimum wage was brought in the 90s, people said it would cause unemployment. Some employers argued against annual leave on that basis, argued against maternity leave on that basis. What's the truth? There's never been more people at work in Ireland than ever before. So there isn't a direct correlation between high wages and high unemployment. It's more complicated than that. But I also do appreciate that if we introduce these changes too quickly and too dramatically, well, then you could have the perverse effect of actually making people worse off. Because the most important right, most important worker's right is the right to work. And that's why we're not doing these things as quickly or as fast as maybe some people would demand, because I do get the fact that we need to make sure that we don't impose too many costs on business too quickly.
You've been very generous with your time, and I'm conscious that you've other engagements to get to. One last question in front of one of the newspapers this morning. Pointed out that you and your partner, Matt, have welcomed a Ukrainian refugee into your home. This is one of the things you said you were going to do. How's it going?
Going very well. You know, she's a private individual, so and we haven't really discussed how we'd handle media queries yet. So, you know, I can't give out any information, obviously, that's private and individual. But it's something that Matt and I decided we'd like to do. Weren't able to do it in the past because we were in an apartment and the second bedroom was effectively our storage space. But now that we have a house, we're able to help and are happy to do so. And, you know, I really feel for what people in Ukraine are experiencing. This is a small thing that we can do to help out, and we're happy to do it.
OK, Tánaiste Leo Varadkar, thank you very much for giving us your time this morning.
Oh, my pleasure.
News Talk Breakfast with Ciara Kelly and Shane Coleman.
In association with AIR.
Weekday mornings at 7 on News Talk.